This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm sorry. You can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I found!
And tame, and tame again.
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Yet more ludicrous US TV fictional football. A severe case of someone addicted to reading out names in Richard Keys' voice. The fresh perspective of a non-football fan while you watch a game on TV. Getting the scoop on the fourth official's electronic board. When will the number one shin pad manufacturer emerge from the pack? Long-range goals at the near post. The ongoing conspiracy to deny us the exact time during football highlights. And the psychological labyrinth of overlapping live TV fixtures. Brought to your ears by Goalhanger Podcasts. This is Football Clichés and your Mesut Haaland Dix. Hello everyone and welcome to Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry and with me to pick through your footballing fascinations and irritations for the month of March are Charlie Eccleshare, hello.
Hello.
And David Walker, hello.
Hello.
Right, before we get stuck into those, we've got a little adjudication panel for you. Starting with Harvey Hinkler, who emailed me saying, my housemate has been rewatching the US drama Criminal Minds recently, and season 1, episode 12, starts with a football training session with an interesting instruction from the coach. Now, this is absolutely classic. US TV program has football in as some incidental background thing and gets it completely fucking wrong.
Tomorrow we're
going to
get beat by penalty kicks, okay?
It's so bad in such a specific way, Charlie, that it's almost like someone is making it up to take the piss out of Americans. That's how bad it is.
Yeah. Come on, guys. Do better.
Halfback. Maybe they're playing sort of 50s tactics.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. They really like the WM.
Charlie, maybe it's just massive overcautious approach from the coach. Could you ever forewarn a team that they might lose the next day by conceding too many penalties?
Unless the next game is a cup game and they're really fancied to win, but the only possible way they could conceive of not winning is if the other team drags us to a penalty shootout.
That is a more logical way of looking at it, and is something that conceivably you could warn your team about. Like, you could, you know, you go out there without the right mindset, they'll hold on for a draw and they'll beat you on penalties.
And then it's a lottery, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. How that could stem from one foul. Sliding doors moment for that foul on that halfback leads to a dreadful penalty shootout. Yeah, I won't dwell on it. I am too cruel. but script writers sort your lives out. Next up, a tweet from ESPN FC, Charlie. Real Madrid have kept clean sheets in back-to-back games with emergency centre-back Aurelien Tchouameni leading the line.
Ooh.
Can you lead the line as a defender? Do you know what? I put this in and I thought, I've got a horrible feeling that Charlie's going to come in with a, I think it can be a centre-back. It can't.
No, I've certainly never heard it.
I mean, you have a back line and you have a front line, Dave. Could you not lead the back line?
I mean, you definitely have somebody playing that role in the defence. One of the centre-backs generally will be the one who's leading in terms of the whether to press up high, the communication, all that sort of thing.
So in a more intangible sense, in an abstract way, they are leading, but not physically leading the line.
They're leading their line, but you would never, obviously...
They're leading a line.
They are leading, because everyone else follows them. You know, it's one like Sunday League. On me, lads, line's on me.
You bloody love doing that. Standing on the edge of your penalty area with your arms outstretched, making sure that people are parallel with your hands, don't you?
I'm actually more of the... I prefer to be led.
Fair
than
enough.
To lead in that situation, to be honest with you. But I think it works, but you just don't normally see it written, that no one normally talks about that.
But also, leading the line, typically, well, often you'll do it as the solo striker. And even if you're not, even if you are doing it as a partnership, there's a kind of obvious division of labour. You're never a solo centre-back or a solo defender.
Ploughing lone furrow in defence.
I mean, I guess if you're playing a back three and you were playing a kind of obvious middle centre-back and then the two either side of you were kind of more full-backs that have been converted into playing in a back three, it might make some sense, but you'd never hear it.
The language of this sort of thing tends to relate to the way that the play's facing in a way, Dave, because you can anchor a midfield and you could be the linchpin of a defence, which implies that, you know, you're supporting everything that's in front of you rather than being the figurehead of it. And then up front, of course, you lead the line. So it's important, I think, to keep that dynamic and not mess with it, ESPN FC, if possible.
Which is interesting, though, because...
Could you say leading the back line, leading the defensive line? Then it just doesn't sound...
I think leading the line as a striker is a physical thing. It's where you position yourself as much as being the figurehead. You lead
the line.
It is
interesting, though, because as a defending is where you hear the, like, line's on me, or we've got to have a good line. Like, you talk about it much more in a defensive sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But yeah, the leading of it just isn't a recognised expression.
Yeah, not having it. Right, final item for the adjudication panel. This time, this came from a source who preferred to remain anonymous to protect relationships. Here is their correspondence. I'm an actor, and one aspect of this is that I narrate audiobooks. This week, I'm recording a piece of detective fiction. Every time I have to read out a name, a suspect, a person of interest, etc., I accidentally do the Richard Keys voice. I can't help it. This podcast has poisoned my brain. I'm literally saying every first and surname with the inflection of Richard Keys. I can't stop. It's like a compulsion. Hopefully no pod listeners will hear the audiobook because they'll be able to tell. So far, the director hasn't noticed, but I'm on thin ice. I would send a sample if I could, but I fear it would jeopardise my already failing professional integrity. This is a different level of living rent-free in listeners' heads, Charlie. This is affecting someone's livelihood.
This is amazing, yeah. And so relatable. I mean, obviously, you know, we all do it. We've talked about it. We do it in our daily lives, and we know many listeners who do it in their daily lives. But yeah, when you're actually being recorded for something else, that's amazing.
Yeah, I wonder whether the director or whoever, the producer, is sort of asking questions, saying, well, why do you...
What's
just,
that about?
Just think, why do you keep saying the names like that? And the guy's like, oh, just something I thought. I just thought I'd bring something to the character.
Just dramatic, isn't it? I guess it is, yeah.
Then having to explain to the director, well, actually, he works with names of a certain number of syllables, actually. Yeah. And it has to be a slightly weird sort of surname, if possible. Now, all right, noted. Yeah, thanks very much for that. And it becomes an industry thing. Who knows? Well, anonymous, your secret is not so safe with us.
Why did you give his partner a Scottish accent as well? That wasn't in the text.
Why does someone keep agreeing in the background? Right, time for the listeners' Mesut Haaland dicks for March. These are the sorts of things that have been grating on you as you consume football. These are your fascinations and irritations of the modern game. Let's kick things off with Alex.
Hi guys, football fascination of mine is just some of the things that non-football fans pick up whenever they're watching games. So an example of this is my mum. She isn't a football fan at all, but she'll sometimes watch Arsenal games whenever I'm watching them. And she often points out that Arsenal are absolutely terrible at corners, and in her opinion, they shouldn't take them. Now then, the other side of this is that I have to have my own internal monologue where I'm deliberating whether I point out to her that Arsenal actually have the most set-piece goals or corner goals in the league this season, or do I just sit along and nod with her and let her think of that as her own wee thing? So I don't know if you guys have any examples of things that non-football fans have thought up and said to you whenever you're watching it, and how you sort of have to hold back from correcting them.
Now, Charlie, you can kind of sympathise with a non-football watcher seeing teams narrowly fail from set pieces quite a lot and think, that's just really rubbish at this. So I can kind of get my head around that. But imagine that sliding doors decision of whether to raise Arsenal's set piece record with your mum to correct her. I think he's kept his discipline well there.
I think as well with this, there are two different things. One is the person who knows kind of nothing about football, and it's the kind of comedic, oh, did we just score? You know, that's kind of, you know, don't even know the colours. Then,
oh, we did a goal.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Unacceptable.
This sounds a bit like the very casual sort of fan. Like, I remember when I was a kid and we'd be watching football at a mate's house, and the dad, who wasn't really into it, would like pop his head around and be like, oh, are we losing again? And I kind of say, like, we're in a really good run of form at the moment. Like, what do you mean, are we losing again? And it, like, that kind of thing is similar to what's being described here.
I'm glad you've raised a male member of the family just to even this thing out, because, you know, I with regret, I'll have to follow Alex's lead, Dave, and cite a female member of the family who have a passing interest in football. My wife just cannot handle teams losing games, especially big ones. We were watching the AFCON final, for example, a while ago, and she just couldn't handle players being on the turf on their haunches having been beaten in a big game. There's just far too much sympathy, and I'm just like, this is football, this is what happens, you'll get over it.
Well, so she was like feeling sorry for them.
Yeah, happens every time, especially the bigger the scoreline, the worse she will feel. I guess, you know, it's very much a human reaction. Mm. Should admire her empathy, if anything.
We should say as well, for balance, like, sometimes an outsider's perspective does provide some sort of clarity. Like, I remember watching, what was it? Must have been season before last, Arsenal Brentford, and Arsenal brought on a 15-year-old kid. And I was kind of like, oh, that's cool, isn't it? They brought on a 15-year-old. My wife was kind of like, isn't that just insane? Like, why are they playing a 15-year-old? Like, yeah. What's that going to do to a 15-year-old playing the Premier League? And I was like, oh yeah, hadn't really thought of that. Was more just thinking they've broken the record sort of thing, which is obviously ridiculous.
She'd fit in well on a podcast that turns the mirror on football and says, look how ridiculous some of this stuff is that we do.
Get her on.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we do the Wags episode. I do identify with this one though, because my mum has kind of gotten into watching football a bit more in the last sort of, I don't know, few years. Like, she'll watch the England tournaments with a bit more interest. Like, I took her to a game at Vicarage Road a few years ago, and the big thing that she always remarks upon is she can't stand any sort of fouls or aggression or like pushing and pulling at corners or anything she can see that there's like a bit of aggression. And which is kind of fair enough, like, that's a fair observation, but the thing she always sort of follows it up with is like, oh, I remember back in when I used to watch when I was a kid, back in my dad's day, there was none of this they all played so fair. And I'm like, well, I could show you a few tackles.
Seen Vinnie Jones.
Just have a look at this Graeme Souness tackle.
Yeah. Less snidey though, wasn't it? Maybe that's what she's
yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, maybe that fresh perspective is what we all need. The next fascination of football comes from Reese Forbes.
Okay, so my slightly odd fascination for football, I'm not sure if anyone else does this, so I'd be interested to know if they do, but it's when at a live game, so I'm a United fan, so at Old Trafford, when a sub's about to be made, or when you know it's about 44 and a half minutes, or, you know, 89 minutes 50, and you know they're going to start getting ready to put the board up for the number for the subs, or for the number for added time, and the fourth official kind of does a little like practice go at lighting up his board, and you get a little flash of the number before he actually shows up properly. I don't know if anyone else does this, but I always find myself trying to get a bit of a sneak peek at the number as he does his little practice flash. And then I can say to the people around me, oh, he's adding on 5 here, by the way. Or I can say which player I know is coming off. If, say, you can see the sub that's coming on, and you try to wonder who they're going to take off and what kind of change they're going to make, you can usually get there and see it before they actually announce it.
Now, Charlie, this is a recurring theme in many forms. It's this kind of prior knowledge of a substitution being made. And some people are really irritated by, you know, like the touchline reporters knowing who's coming on before substitution is made, or knowing how much injury time is about to be added. It's just weirdly critical information before it's released. And this is just another manifestation of this. So why is it so prized?
There is so much information out there, and there's so much competition out there. There is just a thrill at knowing something slightly before other people, especially when you're a fellow crowd member. It's not like you should have any additional insight. So the opportunity to sort of play the insider, I think there is a big appeal to that. Though not that I can't say I've ever done this or seen anyone do it, but I can see why it's fun.
I find myself doing this sometimes, and I think often in little pockets of people that you sit with in games, they're often like one person who ends up being like the default bench spotter,
and they sort of aimlessly distribute that information to people around them. And it's a quiet honor, Dave, isn't it? Being the one who has that information. It's going to be five guys. It's going to be 5 minutes. And everyone's like, what? How do you know?
That is really true. Also, some people keep a close eye. Is this what you mean as well? When people see which sub's coming on, like they'll keep a very close eye on who's been called back or
always been called back. It's been called back.
Who's taking the sort of training top off? Yeah, that is a big one. And they'll kind of mumble it.
Being summoned back. What a thing to observe. Watch the game, mate.
I know. There is it's interesting you mentioned about touchline reporters and stuff there, because a few years ago when I was working on live football at TalkSport, we, after some intense negotiations, were eventually allowed to have access to the Premier League broadcaster's app, which gives you the information of the substitutes and the team lineups, but the substitutes in the game before the board comes up. So when you see all that shuffling down on the touchline, what they're doing is they're telling the Premier League sort of match manager, these are the subs that are going to be made, so the broadcasters see it before the board gets put up, so they're able to be prepared. And you also get the team news 15 minutes early. But honestly, the high security, confidential nature, it was honestly like I was being sworn into the Official Secrets Act or something. They couldn't impress enough upon me how important it was not to share this information.
It's an FPL thing. Like, they get really... There is that. As well. FPL.
Yeah.
Must be. And then obviously, betting, I guess, for example, as well. But yeah, prized information, prized micro information of football. But yeah, the electronic board flickering. Someone's going to go on top of that, Charlie.
Yeah.
The manufacturers.
Yeah. Unless it's there as a little nod to these fans, just to give them something.
Betting syndicates could be having a field day with this sort of thing. Right. The final fascination of football for March comes from Owen Maynard.
My fascination of football is goalkeeper gloves. I don't play in goal, never have, but every now and then I'll be watching like the Saturday game or match of the day, and I'll see a keeper wearing a brand that I just do not recognise. I've looked it up. In the Premier League, we have such brands as The One Glove, Reinat, Titan, a couple of All Sport legends. I just really enjoy the fact that it hasn't been completely taken over by Nike and Adidas.
I really like that sign-off.
Yeah, I was about to say.
I agree.
Is that because it's not commercially viable for them to invest that much in goalkeeping stuff? Because it's just sheer numbers game. There's going to be fewer people wanting to buy goalkeeping gloves.
This is going to be my very first point, Dave. It's, you don't want to see Adidas and Nike spread themselves too thinly. Such is my appreciation of goalkeeping glove brands, Charlie, that I wouldn't trust Nike and Adidas to do it properly. It's a specialist thing.
Well, yeah, I know, and I think that is why there is a satisfaction and a pride that, yeah, the ones with glove heritage continue to prosper.
Members of the goalkeeping community, Dave, are very proud of the goalkeeping glove brands because of that speciality. And as Owen says, a couple of All Sport legends amongst the Premier League goalkeepers. And it made me think, goalkeeper glove brands, very specialist. Boots is very much an open market, but obviously the big players feature heavily. There aren't necessarily many specialist bootmakers. What about shin pads? Shin pads are just an afterthought, aren't they? I mean, we have modern tiny shin pads, but if you think of Sunday league level shin pads, nobody, who's dominating the market there? Sondico?
Well, it's basically you go in when you're buying your kit or whatever in Sports Direct, it's just, you don't need to splash out on the shin pads. Get the basic Sondico 2 for £8.
Well, exactly. But Charlie, there's a rare gap in the football market for someone to stand out as we're the ones who've nailed shin pads.
The really good shin pads.
Your shin, we've put so much research into this. We've nailed the shin pad market. We are the number one. All we do is shin pads.
Yeah, I just don't know if, like, it would require a bit of a behavioural change because, as Dave says, for most people it's such a box-ticking exercise. They're also not seen, so there's that element as well. So it's hard to kind of shout about how great the design is. I guess you could say that, for ultra comfort, you need these shin pads.
I was just looking, when we were talking about goalkeeping gloves, to see whether whether Adidas had extended the Predator range to goalkeeping gloves. And indeed they have several options of Adidas Predator goalkeeping gloves. And it appears the same is true with shin pads. You can buy Adidas Predator shin pads.
Wow.
Oh, let's stick with the gloves for a moment. When you punch it clear, does it sort of curl out?
There's little grooves.
It's got those flappy bits on them.
Oh, I'd love to see it. Owen Maynard supplied some reading material for this, Charlie. It's an article from goalkeeper.com, naturally, running down all the gloves that the current Premier League goalkeepers wear. And I'll give you a random example. Brentford's Mark Flecken. Brentford's Mark Flecken is another Puma endorse. However, the Dutchman has so far switched between an SMU of the Pro Hybrid model and the future Ultimate Negative Cut. The gloves, they differ slightly in their backhand design, as well as their latexes. The future Ultimate model sports Puma's 4mm Elite Plus latex, whilst the Pro Hybrid model uses a 4mm Duo Super Soft latex. Flecken's SMU of the latter doesn't feature a wrist strap.
Wow.
These are the things.
I don't know this for certain, but I feel like gloves have probably gone the same way as boots, in so much that they're smaller and tighter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I expect so. Yeah, I mean, if you think back to those massive ones, those flappy old ones.
They're like little gloves. I suppose it's a bit of a regression, Charlie. You used to have the sort of cotton gloves or wool gloves,
like
with
gardening,
the
gardening gloves.
Yeah, with the kind of, I'm going to say tread, but I don't mean tread, I mean grip on them. And they were the classic childhood ones. Then you got the massive, really puffy ones, which made you feel so safe. I loved wearing those because nothing's getting past me. And then they have regressed to sort of almost like scuba diving gloves. Like, it's like they're really skin tight.
Most equipment has got smaller, hasn't it? I mean, shin pads now are teeny tiny.
Yeah.
We've talked about shorts before and how they've generally got shorter. I mean, you think shirts as well, from how like billowing they got in kind of the late 90s.
It'll come back round again though, won't it?
It will. Yeah, it will.
It's all cyclical, isn't it? Can't see it though.
I was just thinking with shin pads, like, how long do you reckon you've owned your shin pads for? Like, what would it take to replace your shin pads? I mean, I can't even remember when. They must be my longest serving item of clothing.
It's so long ago that you won't remember buying them.
Yeah, I have no recollection of them. They're old. I think they are Sondico. They're
so
black.
Disgusting.
They're just, yeah. Just it's mad like
disgusting.
What it would take to get new ones. They'd have to just snap in half before I got new ones.
I bought new shin pads for the start of this season, because the ones I had before, they were still intact, but they were just looking a bit tired. I think I had them for about 10 years.
I was going to say, I think a decade, if you're doing anything less than a decade, you've got to be asking questions.
Right then. There's your fascinations for Mesut Haaland dicks for this month. We'll be back very shortly with your irritations.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to Football Clichés. We've heard your fascinations of football for March. Now it's time for your irritations. Let's kick things off with Harry Feather.
My admittedly quite weird football irritation is long-range shots going in at the near post. The player that always comes to mind when I think about this is Fabian Schär, sort of striding forward from right centre-back, hitting one from miles out, and it going in to the keeper's left at, or even worse, off the near post. I just think it looks awful. Conversely, I do like when strikers sort of bat one in at the near post inside the box, like Aguero used to do, but from distance, it's just not right.
Harry Feather's bang on here, Charlie. I think I've spoken passionately on this podcast before about long-range shots that go in at the near post. They're not disgusting, but they are inferior.
Vincent Kompany's count as one of these, because that's held up as a kind of, you know, screamer.
It's quite flat on though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty straight.
Depends about whether you could call it the near post or not, really. I mean, he's so straight on. I think it's a shot from
He's inside the width of the goal, I think, when he hits it.
Definitely doesn't count. And it's a glorious goal to watch.
Just about inside.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. And I think that's a good parameter to use, you know, a good base parameter to use for this phenomenon.
How much, though, is this because of that sort of thing that a keeper should never be beaten at their near post?
Definitely not that. It's pure aesthetics. It is pure aesthetics. And the reason for it is, I mean, they're not bad per se, but if you compare them to a shot that goes across goal into the far top corner, let's take, for example, the first goal that comes to mind here is Cristiano Ronaldo for Manchester United against Porto, which was such an expansive goal. It feels like it goes on forever. It's such a big stadium, such a big expansive stadium as well. Everything just looks massive. But it's such a great example of the ball going across the goal into the far top corner, looking so much better than if he'd stuck it into the top right. There is no comparison. Charlie, this is just pure aesthetics here.
Interesting. I know what you mean. I probably don't feel quite as strongly about it, but I'm trying to think of a goal that's really a kind of another example. I can't think of a Fabian Scher one that's mentioned.
I think I do know the one he was talking about. I can't pinpoint the game, sadly, Charlie, but I've got an image of it in my mind. I think it's a good example, but I don't quite agree with you, Adam, and with Harry, in terms of it being, you know, the aesthetics of it and not liking it. I quite like it, and I think it's because...
Do you prefer it?
I don't know if I prefer it, maybe, but I think because there's like a rarity element to it, which I like. And also, I think from the fact of playing football, I can sort of imagine that if I hit a ball to the best of my ability, I could hit one across the keeper or curl one across the keeper once. If I had like 10 attempts, I reckon I could get one into the top corner. I don't think I could smash one in off the laces into the top corner at the near post like you see some players do. Like JJ Okocha's, that free kick against Aston Villa for Bolton where he goes around the wall.
That was ridiculous, yeah.
You know, which again, it's like a free kick. Maybe that makes it a bit better. Charlie, you'll remember this surely. From the FA Cup quarterfinal in 2016, Adlin Gwediora for Watford smashes one in at the Emirates just from just outside the area into the near post. I think it's quite impressive to find the top corner and then to pull it off.
I think if you were aiming to do it, it's technically harder.
I mean, I remember Gamps Pedersen started doing this for more close range ones, not necessarily long range ones. And it almost feeling like a bit of a hack because also the ball takes less time to travel. And it was kind of like you've just smashed it.
Yeah, you're like, why don't you do this more often?
Yeah, there's not that much the keeper can do about it. I watched that Ronaldo Porto one, and the next goal it took me to was another goal at the Emirates, the Ronaldo free kick.
Yes.
Which goes in at the near post.
Exactly. Oh, it's Almunia.
That is awful. I mean,
it is horrible.
But that's partly because it's crap goalkeeping, though. But it looks terrible.
And it's low.
Yeah, it's sort of middle to low.
Let me add a little variable to the equation then, Charlie, because I realise that neither of you are convinced. And this was on the outskirts of my own MHD long list that continues to evolve. No longer. But what's worse, a right-footed long shot going in on the goal on the right-hand side as you're looking at the near post, or a right-footed shot going in and the goal on the left-hand side at the near post? Which is the least aesthetically pleasing? So the Ronaldo free kick or the opposite?
I think that Ronaldo free kick.
Yeah. It is.
I think so.
I think there's something about the goalkeeper. Something about the goalkeeper not being at full stretch in the right way. There's something less impressive to see about it. Well, whilst technically it's probably harder, it's less enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So in the FA Cup fourth round this year, Watford scored a free kick at the near post from the left. A right-footed player from the left, Mateus Martins, and he's kind of nipped it in at the near post. It was like a good bit of quick thinking. And I found that less impressive than if he'd been on the other side and smashed it into the near post from that side. I think it depends about the contact of the foot. Have you sort of bent it in at the near post or have you smashed it in at the near post? I like the ones that get smashed in at the near post.
Fine, fair enough. Right, second irritation for March comes from Peter.
Something that really bugs me about watching football on TV is that why do highlights packages hate showing us the time of when things happened? I understand for graphical aesthetics, it's nice not to have the screen too cluttered, but why are they keeping it a secret how far in between the highlights are happening? Just doesn't make sense to me.
Now, this thing has prevailed very much on sort of YouTube highlights, but the only concession that's ever been made on this, Charlie, is on Match of the Day. And I can't remember when they started putting the minutes on at the start of sequences.
Yeah. I remember it being quite a big thing, especially for those of us who at this time would watch Match of the Day without knowing, not regularly, but from time to time, Boxing Day, for instance, we would tend to watch Match of the Day without knowing the scores. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a weird thing because you would have no idea when in the game it was. And I think it was like mid to late noughties. I want to say around 07, that kind of time that the...
Sounds about right.
That thing would come up saying 30-second minute, just to give you a bit of context, which I do think is helpful. There is something that, yeah, there is a resistance to do it. I think maybe because it looks really jerky, just jump. If you've got, because you'd have
that's
to just
all
take,
I can think of,
yeah, I think just to take the clock and then you're jumping forward suddenly does just look quite weird and not very nice.
Mm. Is there a thing as well with highlights that now that they do have the times of the sequences on Match of the Day, kind of gives away maybe like a last minute winner or incident? If say something happens in the 89th minute and then you come back in the 95th minute, they're always going to show incidents. Something's always going to happen. They're never going to show a nothing.
Yeah, you're always ultimately
going
to know what minute the goal went in. I just don't know what the resistance is to it, Charlie. I mean, I refuse to believe it's purely that just sort of jerkiness. Maybe they should really lean into the fact when they skip from one highlight to the next, they should speed up the intervening football, like spooling tape, and then just get it to the next one, just to show people that, yes, we're moving on to the next bit.
Because it does look quite like jerky home video. So there's something about this kind of sudden leap in time. But there's no reason why on like the Sky Sports app, when you watch like the 3 minute highlights, it couldn't just pop up in the bottom or top corner 41 apostrophe ideally.
I kind of like the not knowing though. I just kind of like the old way of just like trying to work out, is there going to be more after this? Is this it? Is this the end of the game? Whereas when you see the minutes, you kind of get an idea.
You probably preferred it when it was just Gerald Sinstat voiceover instead of an actual commentator, didn't you? And you
very
get
much so.
30 seconds instead of the full three.
On the subject of Match of the Day, so I just quickly Googled this to see when you said, I don't know when they've brought in the thing. So I've tried to find it and nothing has presented itself on Google. But what I did see, the top result was the frequently asked questions page on the BBC website of Match of the Day. So you obviously get bombarded with so many questions that they've set up this thing. Yep. So the questions are, there are 7 frequently asked questions. Top answer, what do you reckon? What's the first one that they get asked most?
How do you choose which game, what order games are in?
Yeah, how do you decide the running order for the programme? Closely followed by, why is my team always on last?
Mm-hmm.
Is Match of the Day available on BBC iPlayer? Why don't you show a repeat of Match of the Day later on a Sunday? Why is there a midweek MOTD some weeks but not others? Do you have a commentator at every match? And finally, why is Goal of the Month no longer a competition?
I really thought there'd be a Goal of the Month.
That was the phone-in scandal, right?
Yeah.
That killed it off. Maybe there was a similar thing. I don't know. But yeah, there's no excuse for it. And hopefully the barriers continue to come down for that. Right, the final irritation of football for March comes from Donny at Mooey.
My footballing irritation is to do with kickoff times, specifically when there is a midweek round of Premier League games, usually on Amazon Prime, and they have some games which kick off at 7:30 and others that kick off at 8:15. This seems like a tiny thing, but as an armchair Premier League fan, it's actually caused me incredible amounts of stress as I decide which game to watch. An example would be from a couple of weeks ago when Brighton played Spurs at 7:30 before Arsenal face West Ham at the Emirates in the later game. My thought process goes something a bit like this. Do I start watching Brighton versus Spurs for the first half and then switch over to the bigger game at 8:15? What if I do that and Brighton versus Spurs turns out to be an absolute thriller? Surely then I have to stick with it. Or do I say no matter what, I'll watch the whole of the early game before I switch over for the second half of Arsenal versus West Ham? Or do I just totally ignore the fact that the early game is happening and sit and watch the build-up to the Arsenal game when I could be watching actual football? I feel like Amazon and the Premier League feel they're doing a really good thing by staggering the kickoffs. If I can't watch 2 games in their entirety, I'll forever be panicking that I've made the wrong decision. I really hope I'm not alone in this one.
Charlie, the beauty of this was always going to be in the deliberations, and Donny Mew have really broken it down for us here. I mean, assuming that you don't have a hugely vested interest in either of the games, let's say they are fairly evenly matched or there is a bigger one on later, what strategy would you employ? And multi-screen is not going to be considered here.
I think, well, yeah, firstly, I tend to quite like when there is this kind of overlap. I know what he means, that there's you're confused. What I don't like is the fact that you don't know straight away. It's not like a... You know on a Sunday when the game's going to be, you know on a Saturday when the game's going to be. That level of having to check, I do find slightly irritating because it's not just following a formula. But I don't mind the double thing, and I would start,
don't
I would 100% start. Don't mind it.
It.
I would 100% start with the 7:30 game, just as a kind of, see it as a kind of bonus, assuming that's the
no
kind
question.
Of equivalent of the 2 p.m. to the 8:15 to 4:30. Ignore it.
Yeah.
See it as a bonus.
Yeah. You can't also choose build up over a game.
I quite like the fact as well, with that split, that the first half finishes just as the 8:15 game's starting.
Mm.
And then You've got 8:15
well, these days, though, the injury time does play havoc with that.
True. Yeah.
Plays into your hands, if anything. It makes you better.
You might miss a few minutes of the start of the 8:15, but then in theory, you've got about 15 minutes where you can watch the start of the 8:15 game, get a sense of, is this going to be better than... And also bear in mind, there is a premium because the first game is going to be the second half. So that's a bit more interesting because you're going to get an outcome. So you can make your mind up at 8:30 and then you can always go back to the 8:15 game later. So I think you can kind of have your cake and eat it.
Charlie's got this bang on to me, Dave. The 45-minute overlap is the perfect overlap. And I mean, not just for the amount of football that you get to watch, but also because there's a pleasant maths in your head that you can do. Like, you're watching one game and you know, the second half's probably about to start in this one. Shall I switch over? And yes, it's a dilemma, but the maths in your head are satisfying. And I think that in my head, rules everything.
Yeah, I do. The only thing I get annoyed about is the actual method of switching between games is it annoys me. The fact that I can't just, if it's Amazon.
That is
annoying. You have to like go for the app. And
yeah.
I'd much rather that they did and I think it would encourage me more to watch the other games if they did like the goal in this sort of inset screen mid-game. So this
is just a great service when that, on the rare occasions that happens, when broadcasters are for some reason suddenly allowed to do it. I think it's a great service. Sure, you should be able to appreciate games in their entirety, but having a goal pop up in the bottom of the screen. I guess the only time you really see it, Charlie, is when you've got simulcast games in a group stage of a tournament, right? And that just feels like, well, that, you definitely should have that because that might affect this game. Just do it to Amazon. Just do it.
Do you get it final day of the Premier League as well sometimes?
Yeah.
Yes.
I feel like they used to do that. And it felt like a real novelty. But I get the anxiety point. I feel that more though like on a Champions League night, there was one, about a month ago, and it was City were playing Copenhagen and Leipzig were playing Real Madrid. Both, neither game was sort of particularly exciting.
Yes.
But I had the feeling of like, whichever I watch, the other one will be quite good.
It is annoying, Dave, when you're faced with, you know, directly simultaneous games, and on a Champions League night being a great example, when you just don't know which game to pick. That annoys me. That does basically beat me down into a non-decisive situation. I end up not watching either of them.
Sometimes, yeah. And sometimes it sort of plays with your kind of viewpoint of football. You think, so does a Inter against Barcelona trump Liverpool or like one of the British teams against a slightly less glamorous team?
Yeah, I think you need to almost try. And what I'll often do, I'll start watching, say, the Barca-Inter game, and then I might be like, I just don't care about this. Whereas I care about what happens in the Liverpool game, even though it might not be as aesthetically pleasing or as interesting a game. I care, so that's going to engage me more. So I'm going to flick to that.
You're absolutely right. I think the cold, hard logic would be to choose the game that is most evenly matched, because that, in theory, could be the better game. And if it's two big names, then you're even more inclined. But fundamentally, and I'm not defending anybody's knowledge or not knowledge of European football, fundamentally, it comes down to which faces are more familiar, really. It comes down to, if you had to scrape some vested interest together, which game has more players that you give a shit about? And maybe it does come down to that, but I would never begrudge anyone picking Inter versus Barca. What a matchup that is, by the way.
It can be as arbitrary as like noise or colour. Like, sometimes you're just like, I prefer the viewing experience of this game compared to that one.
If it's a stadium with a running track, I'm not fucking watching it.
Exactly.
That's a fact.
If it, like, I remember once, you know, back in the day, there was like a quite good Serie A game going on, but it was so quiet and dark, it felt anyway. I was like, I think I'm going to go back to the Premier League 2 p.m. game.
Do the commentators sound like they're really commentating from a booth in southwest London?
There's
no.
That.
Is it foggy from flares? No. All these things count against it.
But to go back to the anxiety point, there is something that sometimes gets me, and this is probably more of a simultaneous thing, but it could be when there's that overlap as well with the Premier League games. If you hear about something amazing has happened, say like a quick flurry of goals, a team's gone up 3-0 or there's been back and forth, they've both scored in successive minutes. You're like, oh, you see on WhatsApp or someone, you see on Twitter, and you're, oh, I've got to switch over. You switch over and then nothing happens for 20 minutes and you've missed the party and you're just annoyed. And then you're worried that the game you were watching, something's going to happen in that
exactly.
one.
Yeah. It spirals out of control.
Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. Yeah, you can't chase it. You can't force it.
But I remember like once, and just to reassure anyone, if they have a bad one of these, that they can, you know, they'll move on from it. In March 2017, I'd been at the horse racing with a friend of mine, and we were on a train coming back. I think my phone had died, and we were like, oh, should we watch the PSG Barca game? see what's happening. It was like the last 10 minutes. Barca were like, what was it? They were chasing four goals or something. So what most people don't remember, there was another game on that night, a Premier League game between Man City and Stoke. And we were like, should we watch City Stoke? Like that's, it was 0-0. We're like, there's more at stake there. Something's more like to happen. So we turn over and watch Man City Stoke for the next 50 minutes and completely miss the whole remontada. And then we'd even forgotten. We were like, oh, I guess, I wonder how that finished, the bus game. And just missed the whole thing.
So you weren't part of it, really. You didn't really experience it, did you? So you could never really talk about it in it with any authority.
And felt incredibly stupid, having sat through the rest of Man City Stoke, which finished 1-0, by the way.
Well, God, I'm a ball of anxiety now after all of that. Brilliant stuff from everyone. Thanks for sending all of those in. Thanks to you, Charlie.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Dave Walker.
Thank you.
I hope everyone stuck with us to the end and didn't flick over to the football ramble or something like that. Thanks very much. And we'll be back on Tuesday.